Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 8th of June. The United States is shifting gears a little bit on pregnancy prevention. Abstinence programs will still be funded in this country, but comprehensive sex education is going to get more money from the government. The budget for this year is devoting $114 million to an evidence-based approach. Most of the money will go to communities that choose programs that have shown that they reduce teen pregnancy. This hour of the program, we'll be talking about those programs and what programs seem to work. We have two guests with us. Bill Albert is the Chief Program Officer of the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. It's a private nonprofit initiative organized in 1996 that focuses on preventing both teen pregnancy and unplanned pregnancy among single young adults. He is responsible for overall program planning and development and for tracking program progress. Before his work here with the campaign, he spent 12 years working in television news, most recently as the managing editor at Fox Television News in Washington, D.C. Bill Albert, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. Also joining us is Julie Downs, who's director of the Center for Risk Perception and Communication at Carnegie Mellon University. Julie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we always do. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I speak to you from the city, Milwaukee, that used to have the highest teenage pregnancy rate in the country. I'm wondering what the figures are nationally, and I'm sure that you must have them, Bill. Are the numbers going down?
Well, there's good news and bad news on that front. The big picture is quite good. In other words, since the early 1990s, this nation has made extraordinary progress on teen pregnancy. The rates are down about 38%. Among teen births, the rates are down by about a third. That is the good news. The not-so-good news is that progress on both of these important rates has come to a standstill and, in fact, has ticked up a bit. So the good news is if you look over the past two decades, this nation has made extraordinary progress on an issue I think that many people once considered intractable. There's been progress in all 50 states. There's been progress among all racial and ethnic groups. The bad news is we have quite a challenge ahead of us because the rates seem to be turning around and going in the opposite direction. Mm.
And what about the rates among people who are in their 20s, particularly their early 20s? I hear that that's really a problem right now, particularly a large pregnancy rate among women who are in their 20s who are not married.
Well, you're absolutely right, and it's an issue that most of us simply don't focus on. When we think of unplanned pregnancy, most of us attach it to teens. And, of course, that is true. The overwhelming majority of pregnancies among teens are unplanned. What people don't know is that we have an extraordinarily high rate of unplanned pregnancy, particularly among single women in their 20s. For example, 7 in 10 pregnancies are unplanned among those women who are unmarried in their 20s. And I hasten to add that these pregnancies are unplanned not because I say so or because the CDC says so. It is because women themselves are reporting these pregnancies as unplanned.
Mm-hmm. Julie, give us an idea of what happens at the Center for Risk Perception and Communication. I understand, and tell me if I'm wrong here, that you will probably get more funding as a result of a change in direction on preventing teen pregnancy. What does your program do, and is your program one that has proved to be effective so more federal funds will come your way?
So what we've done, I mean, here at the center, we focus on all kinds of different risks. Sexual risk is just one of them. But what we've developed, and actually we developed it back in the 90s when so much good work was going on in terms of pregnancy prevention and reduction of sexual risk. And so what we did in that project was to develop an interactive video based on pretty extensive research with adolescent girls trying to understand why they are engaging in higher risk sexual behaviors, really down to a very, very detailed level of what goes on in the situation when they're with a boy, what goes on in their heads when they're making a decision. And we used the results of that research to develop an interactive video that really targets these aspects of their behaviors quite specifically. And so we get into details like girls often don't feel a lot of power when they're in a sexual situation, not so much because of very explicit pressure from the boy, but just because of this sort of global social pressure of that's what you do in that situation, and they didn't see a lot of opportunities to kind of change course. And so in our intervention, we have different girls, you know, played by actresses, who we show in these, you know, very intense situations with a boyfriend, with a new person who they've met at a party, and we really hit the kids over the head pretty hard with our message of, you know, maybe Caitlin doesn't want to do exactly what's going on right here. Here are a bunch of different things she could do. And we do that about five different times within a single scenario so that we're sort of presenting, we're giving the kids, number one, telling them this is an option. You don't have to have sex if you don't want to have sex. And if you don't want to have sex, here are some things you can do. And all this is very extensively research-based. We ran these scripts by girls in our target audience until we got to the point where the girls were saying, yeah, that's definitely something I could say. You know, we don't want to go to the girls and say, you know, here's the kind of message. You know, I hope my parents don't listen to Wisconsin Public Radio. It's like the kind of message my parents would have told me when I was a teenager. You know, you just tell them that you respect your body. You know,
right.
Kids aren't going to say that. And so we got these messages that kids really are going to say, you know, that they're going to feel pretty comfortable. A lot of them sound to us like excuses, but they work. And so that was something that we really focused on to try and give kids the tools that our research showed they really didn't have.
So what works? What do they say?
Well, so what we did with this intervention, there's a number of different parts to it, and we didn't test each part separately. So we don't know, you know, if one part is particularly good and one part isn't good. We just don't have the research to say that. But overall, what we did and what should be done with any kind of intervention is that we did a scientific evaluation where we randomized adolescent girls to either see our video or we had two different control conditions. We were trying to control for a bunch of different things, and so it was a pretty rigorous scientific trial. And we followed them for 6 months, and we asked them at the beginning and then at several times throughout that 6 months about their behavior in quite a bit of detail. And we tested them for sexually transmitted diseases, which was actually our intended outcome. We were looking at disease rather than pregnancy, but of course any behavior that's going to prevent a sexually transmitted disease is going to be pretty good at preventing pregnancy as well. And what we found at the end of 6 months was that the girls who had seen our video intervention were more likely to become abstinent. We only recruited girls who were already having sex, and they were about 2.5 times as likely to become abstinent in the months that followed compared to the girls who were in the control conditions. And then at the end of 6 months, they were less likely to have contracted a sexually transmitted disease.
Interesting.
And so we found some pretty strong results.
Yeah. What about boys, Bill?
Yeah, what about boys?
Yeah.
Exactly. And we've talked about that a lot of times over the years. So we finished this project. I think the copyright on the video is maybe 1998. And then we were sort of moving into some other questions. And one of the big questions is, you know, what about boys? Can you use a very similar kind of intervention where you're focusing on these risks? One of the things we did focus on for the girls was the worry about getting pregnant. They don't want to have to worry about getting pregnant. And boys, of course, you know, they don't want to get a girl pregnant, but it's not really the same for boys. And so we don't have any research on boys. So one of the things that happened in this last decade, starting around 2000, 2001, is that the research money to do this kind of work became very, very hard to get. And so in the end, you know, we sort of turned to other things that we could get funding to do, in part because a lot of money was focused on abstinence-only types of programs. And, you know, our research, our projects based on trying to understand what kids know we know that an abstinence-only approach is not going to achieve what we were trying to achieve. We were pretty explicit about, here are the risks of having sex. Here's how you can lower the risk if you're going to have sex. You know, one way to lower the risk is to not have sex, but there's other ways to lower the risk. And so what we were doing wouldn't qualify for a lot of that funding. So I think boys kind of got left on the sidelines, you know, from our perspective, because the funding just kind of dried up.
Mm-hmm. Bill, what programs do you know of, and how do you reach boys in this country?
Well, it's a great question, and I think the honest answer is, for many years, this was not a problem for boys, unfairly for sure, but teen pregnancy in particular was seen as, frankly, the girl's problem. And it has only really been in the past, I would say, decade plus, that there have been some real innovative efforts to reach guys, both teens and young men. But it is still a rather fledgling affair. As was mentioned, the research on this front is not very strong, particularly with guys. But you know, everyone is trying out new things. It is a new day in many respects, and I think that's a good idea. We have more programs now than we have ever had that are specifically designed to reach guys. We just simply don't yet know, I think, very well what it is exactly that may work with guys.
Mm-hmm. Let me go back to something that you said concerning what's going on in their heads, Julie, and I'd like for you to explain a little bit more about what you've discovered is going on in their heads. Is it... Because at some level you have to be before you're involved in a sexual adventure. It seems as though you must realize what the consequences could be. We have enough information about sexually transmitted diseases, enough information about teen pregnancy. I would think that you have to at some level be thinking in the back of your mind at least about the consequences of early sexual activity. So what is going on in the minds of the young girls you've been talking with?
Yeah, and that's sort of a very popular question with adults, because we have this idea that there must not be very much going on in there, because, you know, and we'll hear people say, adults say, you know, with HIV out there, with all these things out
right.
there, you know, kids are still having sex. It's unbelievable.
Right.
You know, we have to tell them more about these risks. And the reality is, I mean, especially with HIV, is the kids are really quite very aware of those risks. And this may come as a shock, but there are actually other reasons that people have sex. And what's going on often with these girls is a very complex decision process, a sort of social process. They're balancing many, many things, and they're trying to make the best judgments that they can. And so some of the things we found out when we really get into the questions of, you know, how do you make a decision? What kinds of things are you thinking about? What are you looking at? How are you making sense of this? What would you do with this information? What would you do with that information? Is that they are drawing conclusions, but often they're drawing conclusions that aren't the ones that we maybe want them to. So one theme that came up really a lot was that condoms are not 100% effective. And I think that this is a message that's probably told to stress that there are, you know, maybe abstinence, or that there are better ways to reduce risk than just condoms, because condoms don't work 100% of the time. But what we got from these girls a lot of the time was, well, it doesn't always work, so what's the point? Where the reality is, you know, if kids are trained, if, you know, adolescents or adults know how to use condoms well, they're really a lot better than not using a condom if you are going to have sex. And so what we had was a lot of girls deciding not to bother with all the social negotiation that would have to take place to use a condom if it's not even going to work anyway. And so for that, in our intervention, we really targeted, we talked a lot about relative risk. We talked a lot about cumulative risk. So, you know, if something doesn't work very well, then, you know, it's not going to protect you very well. But if something works 99% of the time, which a condom can if it's used properly, then this is going to really lower your risk over multiple exposures. And really to understand, so another thing we found in the research was a huge, huge percentage of condom failures, and which suggests that their condoms are not working very well for this population. They're having condoms break. They're reporting condoms falling off. You don't know exactly what's happening. But essentially, that seemed to be pretty well correlated with not understanding why, how and why condoms work, how to use them. And so we really targeted very explicitly, again, maybe too explicitly for your radio audience, how condoms work, how to get them to work better, you know, what you need to do, what side to put them on, how to roll them, when to, you know, what to do, and why that protects you from the risk. And so we did see an increase over time of in condom use and a decrease relative to our control groups in these failures of condoms, a really pretty big decrease. So they are learning how to use condoms correctly. So that's another thing that we found.
And what have you discovered through the work that you're doing, Bill, about sexual activity among teenagers? Those of us who are now old, consider ourselves old, think that young people are engaging in sex at very, very young, even dangerously young ages. Can you give us some kind of sense of what seems to be okay with teens now, and if they engage in sex much earlier than people of my old generation did?
Well, the news is probably not as bad as you might imagine. When you talk about sexual intercourse, there have actually been declines, again, sort of over the past two decades in the level of sexual activity. And interestingly enough, the rates among teen guys have dropped even more precipitously than among teen girls. But I hasten to add again that the most recent news on this front suggests that the progress that has been made has been stalled out. I think that's one answer to your question. Second answer would be that I think there is, I think it is safe to say that there is a casualness about sex that perhaps wasn't attached to previous generations. So, again, the news, I think, is pretty good in the long run that rates of sexual activity among teens have declined. We have stalled out, unfortunately, recently, and I do think that there is real concern that an activity that perhaps, that obviously has potentially serious consequences is being taken too casually. I mean, I want to echo some of the earlier remarks here that, I mean, really when you talk about sexual activity and contraceptive use, what we have found among teens and among young adults is a whole lot of myths, a whole lot of misperceptions, and a whole bunch of magical thinking all taking place at the same time. So as we've already discussed, this notion that young people simply assume that if condoms don't work 100% of the time, then they're not going to use them at all. There are a lot of myths about contraceptive use. Young people don't have as much information about contraception as you think they might in this information age. And there's a whole bunch of magical thinking. We've talked to thousands of teenagers who say, look, I've had sex 2, 3, 10 times unprotected. I haven't gotten pregnant. Mm-hmm. Therefore, it means I'm infertile.
Oh,
so therefore,
my.
I'm not going to use contraception at
oh,
all.
Oh, my. Ooh. Would you agree that there's a kind of casualness about all this? And obviously the consequences can be quite serious here. Having a child at a very young age is a hard way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, the way that we see that in our data is when girls are talking about these kind of scenarios, they sort of just describe the normativeness. And that's sort of a psychological word that we use, but it's just so normal for some of these social interactions to lead to sex, and that's sort of why they don't see a way of extricating themselves from that path, because it is so normal. So one of the things we found in our research, in one element of the research, we started with some very standard scenarios that were based on some of our earlier work that basically describe exactly what girls told us again and again and again is what happened. Where a girl goes to a party, she meets a boy, she thinks he's cute, you know, maybe he flirts with her, you know, it sort of progresses like that for a little while, and then they kiss, and then he says, oh, do you want to go somewhere alone? And so at this point, we asked the girls, you know, so if she goes somewhere alone with him, you know, what's going to happen? They said, well, she's going to have sex, of course, because why else would she go somewhere alone? And we said, well, what if she didn't want to have sex? Is there anything she could do? And what the girls, not all of them, but really a surprising number of them said, well, she really shouldn't have gone to the party. This idea of going to a party is just opening up this pathway to sex, and there's no way to deviate from that once you're in it. And so it's sort of a casualness. It's just an expected behavior. And what was surprising to us was just how common this story is, that you go to a party, you know, and some kids were describing lines outside of bedroom doors of kids waiting to go in to bedrooms and have sex. And it just being very, very normal, and I think, you know, and I think casual, that this is something, and it's, they weren't really describing this, you know, overwhelming desire or even this really incredible pressure from the boy. I think we sometimes tend to think, oh, the boys are kind of, you know, convincing the girls and they're working there, you know, but they were just sort of just, and so we haven't done the research with boys, so I don't know how they would describe it, but, you know, they were just describing this as a very normal thing. This is what happens, and they really didn't see a lot of ways to have a normal social life, because you don't necessarily want to say to teenagers, okay, never go to parties, that's the solution. You know, I mean, kids want to go to parties. What you want is for them to have a normal social life, but if they don't want to be having sex, if they don't want to be engaging in high-risk behavior, you want them to have the tools, you know, to avoid those risks.
Right. So how do we become so casual about all of this, Bill? That's extraordinary, what Julie was just describing.
Well, I think what Julie says is this notion, whether it's not correct, but this notion that sort of everybody's doing it. And in fact, when you look at the data, it suggests that among high school kids, only about half have had sex and half haven't. But the perception, the overwhelming perception among many young people is, I'm the only person in this entire school that hasn't had sex. That's the way to think about it, and that's becomes very normative behavior. So we have a casualness about sex, but we also have this casualness about using contraception. I mean, just startling, again, I use the term magical thinking. You talk to young people, and they themselves say, I really, really don't want to get pregnant right now or cause a pregnancy. And then the very next question you ask them is, what's the likelihood that you'll have unprotected sex in the next 3 months? And a majority will say, I'd say it's pretty good. The chances are pretty good. So there is this disconnect going on here, and that is, I think, the real challenge.
Phone calls we go to in just a moment. We're talking about teen pregnancy prevention and the administration making more money available for programs that work. So we've been asking this question for a long time, but it seems as though both our guests have a handle on what might work here, because more money will be available to communities who show. And we'll talk more with our guests about how you prove what programs work so they can be replicated. We have two guests with us. Julie Downs is director of the Center for Risk Perception and Communication at Carnegie Mellon University, and Bill Albert, chief program officer of the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for both of our guests, starting with Scott from Madison. Hi, Scott.
Yes, hi. I have two quick questions. Feel free to answer either. You had said before that we had made lots of progress in the 90s in terms of reducing teen pregnancy, and that there was a recent turnaround. I want to know what you thought of how did the policies of the last administration in terms of supporting strongly abstinence-only sex education affect that? And another question is, I'm in college right now, and a large number of my friends actually don't. They don't want to use condoms. In fact, one of my friends said it's like... sex with a condom is like taking a shower with socks, and a lot of people favor using just birth control as their only form of birth control, and I kind of feel like that's, you know, the pill rather, and I kind of feel like that's like your guest said, magical thinking. And I want to know what your guys thought about that. And with that, I'll take my comments off the air.
All right, Scott, thank you. Bill, you want to start?
Yeah, I'll take a crack at the first question. You know, I think that the truth of the matter is we will never know the actual impact of the overall investment in abstinence-only programs over the past 8 to 10 years. It is at the same time these programs were in full flower, was a time that we saw sort of progress waning, both in declines in sexual activity and improvements of contraceptive use. I'm hesitant to make a one-on-one sort of connection between the two. Suffice it to say that I think it is very evident that young people and young adults simply do not have the information that they need about contraception. And I think that's rather stunning in this 21st century when the information, almost any information you need, is at your fingertips through the internet. It is still quite clear that many young people don't have the information they need. You know, if I were going to list 5 to 10 reasons why I think progress has stalled and the rates are ticking back up, I would probably put this lack of information about contraception on that list.
Hmm. Julie, you want to talk about Scott's comments?
Yeah, it's really the idea of using birth control pills as the only method of birth control, and obviously that is a pretty good method of birth control on the continuum, but of course it does nothing to prevent sexually transmitted diseases, which some of which can have lifelong effects. And I have been surprised, my undergraduates sometimes, when we talk about, I'll teach a class on health behaviors and we'll talk about sexual health, that a number of my undergraduate students here at Carnegie Mellon won't realize that a birth control pill does nothing to prevent sexually transmitted disease. And in part, I think that reflects just a lack of understanding of how this disease is going to get transmitted. You know, what could the pill possibly be doing to prevent that disease? And, you know, there are a number of HIV is pretty low prevalence in many of these populations, but there are a lot of other diseases that are very
yes.
high prevalence, and the chance of getting them is very high, and they can have lifelong effects, infertility, symptoms that continue throughout one's entire life. So, often I think that gets overlooked.
Right. Let's go next to Sue in Verona. Hi, Sue.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
One of the concerns that I have is I feel that we as adults are allowing our children to carry on these myths just by evidenced in our student newspaper. Over the last couple of months, there have been articles written by students that promote the myth about casual sex. Also, we've had articles about, well, if you don't remember to use a condom, don't worry, there's always the morning after pill, just don't make it addictive. And so that's allowed to go out to the student population, and there's no, there's no discussion. Often the kids don't bring these student newspapers home, so kids, parents aren't aware that some of this is going on. But I feel like as a social culture, that we allow this to continue, these myths and the expectation that our kids are going to have casual sex.
So is this in letters to the editor, or where is this being published?
These are in the student newspapers. These are the articles that the kids have written themselves that are allowed to be published, that are distributed to the student body. So, these are concerns that I have, and I have brought them up to other parents, and there's a mix of reactions. Some parents say, well, that's just how kids live nowadays, to some outrage by some parents. But I feel like we are allowing this type of...
Allowing the casualness. Bill, what do you think about this?
Well, this may not be an exact answer to the question, but I think it brings up an important topic, particularly when we're talking about teenagers, and that is the critical role that parents have and helping young people navigate adolescence in general, but in particular to address these topics in the family. One way to dispel these myths is if, you know, mom and dad are talking to these kids, and I'm not talking about a, you know, one-time white-knuckle conversation. I'm talking about an ongoing 18-year conversation that parents should be having about relationships and values and sex and contraception and when and under what circumstances to start families. You know, this, there are no guarantees in life. There are no guarantees about being a parent, but when you look at surveys that this organization have done, that has done, and other organizations have done, if you look at sort of the past three decades of social science research, it points to what I think many parents would consider a counterintuitive finding, and that is they, parents, influence their kids' decisions about sex more than peers, more than popular culture, more than the media, et cetera. And I think that's good news for parents. I just don't think that they know it.
Yeah. Here's a great email that's come in, Julie. Let me get your response. Gina, my son is 17, and we have had very open and, at first, very uncomfortable conversations about sex during his teen years, starting very young with the proper names for body parts to almost desensitize him in preparation for the teen years conversation. He and I had a contract for him to wait until he is at least 17 in order to have sex. We have reached that milestone last month, and I'm wondering what advice you could give me going forward.
Well, I would say so far, you know, you've done a lot right. You know, having that conversation, like Bill was saying, setting up that dialogue, being somebody who your son can talk to. Now you've gotten to the point where you've, you know, your son has presumably upheld his end of the bargain, and you've reached a point where at some point you had decided, you know, it wouldn't be the end of the world if he had sex now. Well, if he does have sex now, there's a whole bunch of things he needs to know to reduce the risk. You don't want him to get his girlfriend pregnant. You don't want, you know, him to contract a disease. And so helping, getting him access to information and continuing to be there for him to ask. And you may not know a lot of answers to questions that are going to come up because most people really don't know, you know, how, what kind of information are out there, what are the chances of something happening. But to go with him and sort of find these answers to the kind of questions that he has, sort of enable him to do that information search on his own, and to enable him to think about, you know, the meaning of sex within the context of a relationship, and is that something that is going to be good for him at what point, and is that something that might have not just health risks but also, you know, social risks. What does that do to a relationship? What does he think about his girlfriend or his relationship? And just being there to talk to him and to help him sort of seek out that kind of information and really make a decision about what he wants to do rather than being in a situation where all of a sudden the decision is kind of made for him because
right.
It's just, you know, things just kind of go in one direction and he gets swept along. I suspect boys get swept along, as, you know, possibly as often as girls get swept along without really deciding to. And it just kind of goes in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good response. Thank you, Sue, very much for the call. I think you have a son who's 15 years old. At the risk of getting too personal about this, I assume he's not listening to the radio right now, Bill. But you have to deal with this in your household. Your son is 15, Harrison?
Yes, he just turned 16. And he is, of course, perfect in every way. Yeah, well, it is an ongoing challenge, you know, it's slightly horrifying to him, understandably, that his father is in this business talking about teens and sex and pregnancy and all of that stuff. It is understandably horrifying. But it is something we have discussed over the years, and I hope in age-appropriate ways. And I hope that, you know, he has heard some of these primary messages.
Yes, I'm sure he has, with you as his dad, right?
Yeah.
More phone calls in just one moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about preventing teen pregnancy. Comprehensive sex education is getting a boost from the federal government. The Teen Pregnancy Prevention Initiative. This is something new and something old. The federal budget devoting $114 million to an evidence-based approach. Abstinence only is still funded, but most money will go to communities that choose programs that have shown they reduce teen pregnancy. 28 programs have met the funding criteria, and 20 of those have had evidence of impacts on sexual activity, sexual initiation, number of partners, or frequency of sexual activity. 9 for contraceptive use, 4 on STDs, and 5 on pregnancy or births. More phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to phone calls now. Zeke is next from Scales Mountain, Illinois. Hi, Zeke.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you? Great show as usual.
Fine, thanks.
Thank you. I appreciate the chance to be on. I just want to bring up an important point, I think, to carry on after what something you had said and a previous caller regarding the way kids are today and also with parental influence. And that is a pretty simple word. It's called shame. I think it was pretty effective back in the 60s, 70s, maybe in the 50s and 60s, but not so much the 70s. Things changed. But the point is, there was a fear of actually having a pregnancy, a shame to it.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's to the point where it's actually, in my opinion, actually celebrated. Single mothers, oh, isn't that too bad? Let's help out the single mother. And it's celebrated every Mother's Day. And there's no, and I'm not saying it should go back to shame. I'm just saying there is no fear at all. In fact, they also, these children know that their parents will take care of them. 40, 50-year-old people are raising their grandchildren as their children now. So they see it very loud and clear, not through this, what sociologists see, but through what I call CNN, Kids News Network. They know from each other that this is what happens. You know, you get knocked up, mom and dad take care of us, no big deal. They don't have any understanding of the horrible ramifications of raising a child singular, but they have no fear because it'll be taken care of. And some people say, too, through social spending, but it's predominantly through the older parents. So there's no deterrence in any way, shape, or form. And also, can be emotional. There's a racially charged aspect, too. It's kind of cool for the young ladies to be interested in the rap star type guy. Maybe used to be the 50s, 60s, the good-looking quarterback. But today's guy that's wanted is a kind of a thug kind of guy. So they're ending up with guys like these, and it's not a good situation. But again, that's emotionally charged. People think that's racist. It's just the way it is. But bottom line is there's no shame, and it's actually encouraged. So that's part of the problem with parental influence.
Thanks, Zeke, for the call. Julie, you want to take this one?
My understanding, and I don't have a lot of data, so Bill may be able to augment this. I think he probably has some better data than I do. But my understanding, certainly from a psychological perspective, is that shame is really not a great motivator a lot of the time, especially for things like preventing pregnancy. My understanding is that what the real outcome, one large outcome, I should say, of this change in acceptability of being a single mother has been a reduction in adoptions. You know, so it's sort of at the end stage of the pregnancy that effect is having an effect on behavior, that lack of shame. It used to be that the idea of being a single mother was so shameful that a lot of young women would give their children up for adoption because it was pretty unthinkable for many people to be that single mother. Whereas now, when women are in that situation, there is less shame about it. And I think I was recently reading an article, and so I don't have great data, but it suggested that a lot of the reduction in shift in acceptability of becoming a single mother has led more women to keep rather than give their children up for adoption. And, you know, you could take either stand on whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. But just in terms of an empirical outcome, that is one of the things that's happening. At the level of preventing that pregnancy, I think a lot of times the idea of the possibility of getting pregnant is not figuring into the decision very, you know, you think that would be one of the most important things in that decision. But, you know, and I think Bill was sort of alluding to this as well and describing, you know, how kids are like, I really don't want to get pregnant, but I'm still going to have, you know, unprotected sex. And so the idea of the shame of the being, it's this very distal kind of outcome. And so that, I think, comes into play much, much later in pregnancy. And so I think that's, that certainly is having social effects, but I think not at the level of pregnancy prevention from what I understand.
Mm, interesting. An email for you, Bill, concerning alcohol. This is from a young person who valued her virginity. She says remained a virgin until she was 20. By the time she was 23, she had an unwanted pregnancy. One important topic was the danger of alcohol use mixed with sex. Do sex ed classes today address alcohol use? I ask this because I imagined all those teens that you described as lined up outside the bedroom to be also at a party with alcohol.
Well, it's a very, very important point. Needless to say, young people and adults, for that matter, usually aren't thinking all that well in the heat of the moment. They are not using their most critical thinking. And if you are drunk or if you're high, needless to say, your skills in this area are even more diminished. It is a very important topic. I think it is one, I believe it's safe to say, that more sort of traditional sex education programs, such as they are beginning to address. Some of the recent data just out last week from the CDC suggests that the proportion of high school kids who say that they've been drinking before they had sex is remaining at about the levels that we've seen now for the past 10 years. It's not getting much better, but it's not getting much worse. But it is obviously a real, real concern and should be addressed.
Right. Janet is next from Cornell. Hi, Janet.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a comment, I guess. I keep hearing she and she's pregnant and she didn't protect herself, et cetera. How do we incorporate these young men, these pregnant young men, into this adventure? You know, even if the girl decides to keep the child, the father has a right to be in that child's life. If he's not incorporated from day one, that connection is never made. And these children never really get to know their real father. So I guess my question is, why don't we make these boys?
All right. What, Bill, you want to take this one?
I missed the last part. I think she's saying, I think what she's asking is, why can't we get more guys to stick around?
Right.
And she's exactly right. Unfortunately, the vast majority of teen fathers or young men who impregnate teen girls do not stick around. That's the reality. That's the cold, hard facts. You know, there have been several things tried, including, financial punishment for the guys. The problem is so many of them don't have any money to begin with. There's not much of a disincentive there. But the overall point is exactly right. If we are going to make continued lasting progress in preventing too early pregnancy and parenthood, we absolutely must develop messages, programs, and interventions for guys.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not turning a pink pamphlet into a blue pamphlet. It has to be something more substantive than that. And we haven't done a great job, and we really need to focus on this.
You know, in some ways, and this sounds very simple, but I wonder if you incorporate this, Julie, or if successful programs do. The one thing that probably a lot of these young people are just not thinking, because they don't have an idea of what a huge thing it is to have a child. It is so all-encompassing. It is for a good chunk of your life. You have to devote many, many hours to the health and well-being of another human being. And you would think that somehow we would be able to take that in, but maybe you can't do that till you have a child. I don't know. It's such a big thing to do in life.
Yeah, well, and I think a lot of times, you know, when we want to give a message, especially from adults to children or to teenagers, we have a tendency of trying to really, we want them to grasp the magnitude of how
yes.
big of a deal this is.
Right.
And sometimes we even, I mean, certainly, you know, being a high school you know, student and having a child is a really, really, really big deal. We want to kind of scare them with this and make sure they really get it. But there's a lot of psychological research that suggests that when you take these kind of very scary messages, and you know, having a child may be like that, certainly, you know, if you get HIV, you know, develop AIDS and you will die, that's a very scary message. But these fear messages often lead kids to, or anybody, kids or adults, to kind of disconnect. They don't want to think about it. It's so scary. They don't want to think about it. And so one of the things that has come up time and again in the HIV research is that then the idea of condoms gets kind of tied to that fear. And so people don't want to think about condoms because it makes them think about that fear. And so it can really backfire. And so there's some more recent research on these fear appeals that suggests that you really need to tie it. So one thing is to not use a really overwhelming, scary message. But, you know, if you do use some kind of scary message, to really tie it to, here's the exact thing you need to do, you know, to prevent this thing from happening, so people can kind of feel like they're in control over that fear rather than that they're just at the mercy of that fear. So one of the ways that we dealt with it in our intervention was really to avoid fear. We didn't have you know, long sections where we talked about how awful, you know, how having a baby would ruin your life, how awful these sexually transmitted diseases were, how it'd be. So we talked about, because those are also things that might happen and might not happen. Mm-hmm. And so you can think, well, it probably won't happen to me. We want to focus very proximally, right there in the moment. I do not want to be worried. I just want to feel like I've done what I can. If I have sex, I'm going to be worried. If I have sex without a condom, without birth control, I'm going to be worried. And I just don't want to worry. And so you can kind of focus it on something that's less threatening and just very much closer to the situation. So I think even though it's horrifying, you know, to think like, man, these kids, they're going to have children and they're still children themselves. We need to, you know, like get that into their heads. And, you know, and yet those efforts sometimes make people just like, well, I don't want to think about that.
Oh, that's
and
interesting.
So it has a tendency sometimes to even backfire. It's very counterintuitive.
Isn't that interesting? I haven't thought of that before. I don't want to worry. It's a much better way to go. Isn't that something? All right, let's go to Kathy from Waupaca. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I grew up in the before time of the came of age in the 1980s, and it was still an embarrassment to buy birth control then, but I thought to myself, it's a lot easier to do this and deal with the embarrassment than to get pregnant. And I was in college at the time, and I thought, self, if it can happen to anybody, it can happen to me too. So maybe just being a little bit of a pessimist might have saved me a bit, because it made me plan and think, I'm with a guy that I can trust, and I have to say I am married to this guy for nearly 21
years.
Oh,
my. Congratulations.
Thank you. So I don't think I buy the fact that the information isn't that difficult to get. It's not that expensive. You have to swallow your pride a little bit and pay for it, but, you know, what's the alternative?
Bill, you want to take this caller?
Well, I think it's a critically important point that we often overlook. We adults often talk about information and access to contraception, and those things are absolutely essential, no doubt about it. But we often miss this more critical foundational issue of motivation. A teenager is not going to not have sex, if I can use a double negative, and they're not going to use contraception consistently and carefully unless they're motivated to do so. If motivated to do so, those people who really want to avoid pregnancy tend to do so. They tend to avoid it, and they find ways to do it. You know, the analogy I always use is, you know, my son is 15 years old, doesn't have a credit card, doesn't have a car, but if there's a concert he really wants to go to, he figures out a way to make it happen. You know, he involves other kids,
right.
Some parents involved. He's motivated to go see that concert. He makes it happen. If we can motivate kids either to not have sex or to use contraception exquisitely carefully, then I think we're halfway home then.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. We've had a couple people, Julie, interested in your specific program, and I'm wondering if there is a way to find out for those who are in this field, and that includes everybody because we're all interested in education of this sort. How do we find out about the programs that work? And is your program duplicated anywhere in the country, Julie? And do you know what programs we ought to go to? Bill, Julie, let's start with you.
So I can certainly start by talking about our program. So the name of our program is What Could You Do? Because we're putting girls in this situation and trying to help them imagine themselves doing something other than, you know, ending up having unsafe sex. And so there's information about it at whatcouldyoudo.org. And you can see little clips of the video and read the science behind it and get some information about it. There are a number of, really many of the interventions that work are implemented in community settings. They require hiring facilitators and sort of facilitator-led groups with kids, and so a parent would have a hard time really implementing that on their own. Really, it would be impossible to implement on their own, but what they could do is contact their local, I don't know, maybe Planned Parenthood organization or community organization and get a sense of what kind of things are being implemented. Our program is just an interactive DVD, so they can just stick the DVD in their TV and watch it. And we sell it quite cheaply because, you know, really just to sort of keep our ability to keep producing it and reselling it.
Mm-hmm.
And we have had a number of, really a number of counselors, you know, psychological counselors, doctors, and a number of parents purchase it just, you know, for their kids or, you know, for whatever audience they have because it is so easy to just do that.
Okay. And we're almost out of time, Julie, so I have to cut you short. Bill, what about the national campaign? How do people get information?
Well, I encourage them to go to our primary website, which is thenationalcampaign.org.
Okay. Thenationalcampaign.org. And for both organizations, we will put those on our Facebook page as well, right? So go to the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thank you. What an interesting hour this has been. Thanks to Julie Downs, Director of the Center for Risk Perception and Communication at Carnegie Mellon University, and Bill Albert, Chief Program Officer of the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production, and thanks to you as well for being a part of it. Until tomorrow.